office in your country. Africa has the youngest population on Earth and some of the oldest leaders in the world. What helps and what hurts younger candidates who challenge their elders in African politics?
ENSAS was just a reawakening to say, hey, hey, young people, wake up. You are not on the table. There are people on the table that clearly don't have your mentality and are not thinking the way you're thinking.
We'll speak to young Nigerians running for office in next year's election and examine why they're gearing up for a David versus Goliath showdown at the polls.
The world is changing and it needs someone who understands us, the youth.
Also, black women candidates looking to make history in the upcoming U.S. midterm elections. We've got questions. Why has America never had a black woman governor before? And we'll bring you the story of the Nigerian-American politician leading the push to make Washington, D.C. America's 51st state.
Together, we will fight for change and finally achieve D.C. statehood.
We've got great guests and a great show lined up for you, so stick with me. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Hello and welcome. I'm Haydee Adams. Thank you for joining me. Nigerians go to the polls in 2023 to choose their next president, legislators and governors. And all eyes will be on Africa's most populous nation to see who will lead that country. 79-year-old President Muhammadu Buhari's second term is coming to an end and he's not eligible to run again. Many young Nigerians see a unique opportunity here to contest the elections at every level of government. But how hard is it for young newcomers to run for political office in Nigeria? And what does the road to 2023 look like for those attempting to unseat the so-called old guard who have run the country for decades? Timothy Obiezu is in Abuja for us and went to find out.
Chanting in solidarity, youth-led civil society groups and activists pressed on Nigerian authorities to sign an amended electoral reform bill. Days later, in a major win, the Nigerian president passed the bill into law.
The current bill comes with a great deal of improvement from the previous electoral bill 2021.
The bill promotes early planning of elections, inclusivity and transparency. And activists say these are very important ahead of the polls in February of next year.
The bill also allows, you know, for electronic transmission of results. This is important because it will deepen the integrity of the results collation process, which is one of the weakest links, you know, in our electoral process.
But the bill is only a means to an end. It's not the reason Nigeria's youths are keen about next year's elections, says Godbless Otubere, one of the organizers of the electoral reform demonstration.
ENSAS was just a reawakening to say, hey, hey, young people, wake up. You are not on the table. There are people on the table that clearly don't have your mentality and are not thinking the way you're thinking.
In October 2020, protests against police brutality rocked nearly every Nigerian city for about 2 weeks. Young activists demanded the disbandment of SARS, or the Special Anti-Robbery Squad of the Nigerian police, over a long history of torture and extrajudicial killings. But the protesters later expanded their demands to include calls for better governance and accountability. The protests were met with a fierce crackdown by authorities and were halted. But young activists say the aftermath is the birth of a politically conscious youth population.
Young people are becoming more aware of the very important role that young people have to play in our political system, in democracy, in governance issues largely. Many young people showing their aspirations, whether it is just a simple declaration that we've seen a few younger people also say, I'd like to be the governor of the state or the president of Nigeria.
For decades, Nigeria's political positions have been mostly occupied and controlled by older citizens, but young activists say that could change soon.
They are aiming to occupy up to 50% of the political seats, mostly at parliament and local government levels, by next year. And to achieve this, they say more young people must be legally registered to vote. For weeks, God Bless Otubere and his team have pitched their tent in Abia State, southeastern Nigeria, and have been offering voter education to local communities there. Otubere heads the non-profit Ready to Lead Africa initiative, which focuses on youth-centered advocacy and leadership. He says one community at a time, they're winning the interest of young voters and getting them registered for next year's elections.
The goal is to register as many people as possible, especially first-time voters across Nigeria. Ready to Vote is mobilizing first-time voters, getting them registered so that they can vote in 2023 and other elections moving forward.
The initiative is expanding to 11 other Nigerian states in the coming months. But it is not the only initiative encouraging youth participation in politics. The Youth Initiative for Advocacy, Growth and Advancement Africa, or YAGA Africa, has been mentoring young aspirants and providing them with financial support to run for office. Political campaigns in Nigeria can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars depending on the aspirant and political party.
Money is very important for young people who are running for office, and we encourage young people to actually have a budget or have a plan on how you're going to raise money, whether it is from family, whether it's from friends, whether you're going to crowdfund one way or another. Thankfully, there are also some organizations that are able to provide some levels of support.
Next year's polls are arguably the most significant in Nigeria's recent history. Experts say issues of police brutality will be remembered as the days get closer and could influence decisions of thousands of voters. But activists say they're simply upholding a promise they made to thousands of NSARS protesters to stand up to political orders that do not represent their interests. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Timothy Obiezu there for us in Abuja. Timothy, thank you for that great report. So what is it like in your country? Is the political landscape for young people different or in parallel with Nigeria? Well, today we're going to look at the realities of running for office, especially for those new to the world of politics. What does it take to build a winning campaign and for this generation to contest elections up and down the ballot? Well, to help us understand this, I'm joined by Temi Ibirogba. She's a sub-editor for the Republic Journal. Also with us is Aisha Osori. Aisha is a director at the Open Society Foundation and the author of the book Love Doesn't Win Elections, in which she documents her experiences contesting the primaries for a seat in Nigeria's National Assembly as part of that country's ruling party. Ladies, a warm welcome to Straight Talk Africa. And Aisha, I'm sure people who have run for political office in the past will tell all of us that it's about turning out your base of supporters and, of course, then some, and that it's your ground game that matters most. Now, you've been there and done that. Is it really all it takes?
It takes a lot more preparation to get things like this to win an election in Nigeria. I think, first of all, it would be the platform that one chooses. So young people who are planning to run for office will be struggling to decide what platform to run from. The major parties are not particularly democratic, and so that's usually one of the first challenges that they have. And so they need to find their own platforms to run. I think the second one is just how expensive elections are. I mean, roughly, I think recently there was a conversation where the price tag of being a governor of one of the 36 states in Nigeria is supposed to be as high as $2 billion. So that's the second challenge, the cost of campaign. And then the third will also just be the culture between voters the electorate, that is, and politicians, on what is expected of every good politician to be able to win an election, which is typically what we call stomach infrastructure, where people expect to be given something, an inducement, an incentive to vote one way or the other.
Timmy, President Buhari signed into law the Not Too Young to Run a bill ahead of the 2019 election, and that essentially lowers the age limit to run for president from 40 to 35. And of course, this essentially opens up the field for more young people to run, or at least it's supposed to. But from what you've seen, did that really make a huge impact in terms of more young people now holding elected office? I mean, we didn't see a younger president emerge, and youth voter turnout was essentially low on election day. Does a charismatic new leader have to emerge first? Think young Barack Obama, who will essentially energize young voters and turn them out. Or do youth have to turn up the vote first, and then that is what drives people to the polls, and so they can elect their candidate of choice who they believe will bring about change? What is the disconnect here?
Yeah, I think it's a mix of both that's needed. You need a leader or a candidate who is charismatic, like you said, who can inspire people to get out to vote. And you also need to encourage the youth to get out to vote as well, because there is a lot of voter apathy. You said we saw that in the 2019 elections, because there's just so much deeply rooted corruption in Nigeria that many people, specifically the youth, have seen their whole entire life. You know, that's all they've ever known. So, of course, they're going to think that their vote doesn't mean anything. But I think revolutions like NSARS is what it takes for young Africans to find themselves in leadership positions. We saw a lot of young leaders emerge from those demonstrations. You had people like Renu, like FK Abudu, and the rest of the feminist coalition as a collective, Modupe Odele, and many others. And also, it's important to note the amount of women that were a part of making that possible. And with NSARS, we saw, a lot of people feel like this is a way to look towards the future now. A lot of people did not believe that the current government would actually, do any of the changes they said during their protests. So instead, they were looking towards these next elections as a way to change the leadership and actually, affect change.
Aisha, as Timmy there intimates, that NSARS is probably really the tipping point, and that things could look very different this time around. But I'm sure the mechanics of campaigning, of running itself, I'm not sure if a lot of that has changed, has it? I mean, you've been on the inside in this world of election campaigns and fundraising. You alluded to it earlier. But can you walk us through the mechanics of how parties are funded, how delegates are picked, and the power of money and information? What did you find?
Well, thank you, Heidi. That's a long order, a tall order for me to fill. But I'll start with what you mentioned in terms of where the changes are possible. I don't want to focus too much on the challenges. Now, for me, the first thing that I would talk about is the money matters, just how expensive elections are and how parties are funded. So the typical two winning parties, the PDP and the APC, are not funded by members' dues, but they're funded by the governors, the legislators, who are already elected and so have access to public funds. And that's how traditionally, since the 60s, political parties have been funded in Nigeria, which is why it's really hard to build a viable party, because the culture is not that members fund the party, but that, a few strong men with deep pockets fund the party. Now, what could change would be young people like the NSARS people that Temi mentioned, starting their own organizations. And we could see, and that's something that's really quite encouraging from the NSARS movement, where they were able to raise millions of dollars in a very short time. So we've broken the jinx, and we can show that when we care about something passionately enough, we can raise the funds to do that. So that's one good thing. The second thing is about the delegates and the primary system. Now, so it comes back to your membership. If your members are not known and are unknowable, in the sense that you could never find a verifiable list where, let's just say Aisha Osori is on this list for, let's just say, the PDP, and you will not find my name or some corresponding alias in the APC. Now, if you don't have members that are knowable, then when it comes to the primaries, it's almost impossible to be sure that the people who have been picked as delegates are actually real party members or just people that have been picked from the street to vote during the primaries. And in a couple in the past in Nigeria, we've seen evidence where people, I think investigative journalists, went around the different primaries for the two major parties and found the same people on both lines on different days voting during the primaries. So that's another thing that I would say is a big obstacle to young people being able to get involved in politics. And if you anybody who's following the developments in the APC, the All Progressive Congress, which is the incumbent party of the president, you find that they've had to postpone their convention. And it's all tied to preparations for the primaries, for the presidential elections and the gubernatorial elections coming forward for 2023.
Timmy, what is the incentive to change that, really? You know, that, as Aisha was saying, it's a tall order to fill, but it also seems a tall order in terms of the many things that need to change. What's your take?
Yeah, honestly, for the people who are currently in power, there is no incentive for anything to change. Like I mentioned before, Nigeria suffers from a deeply corrupt political system. So it's no benefit of the people in power to change that because, you know, they would lose power. And this is how they make their money.
Timmy, I just want to stay with you. We've seen the power of social media and how young people in particular use it to great effect to express their economic and political dissatisfaction. How is social media having an impact on political campaigns for younger and for older candidates?
Yeah, it's definitely a way for people to congregate and discuss their game plan and how, you know, Nigeria could potentially change for the better in the future. And you're seeing a lot of young people, you know, in the aftermath of NSAS, you know, trying to organize things like Nigerian history and constitution lessons so that ahead of the elections, we actually understand, you know, the rules and regulations that are in place and how we can maneuver within the system. You have media outlets like Culture Custodian. They just started a podcast called The Fourth Republic. And it's meant to be nonpartisan, leaning, and just seeking to chart and contextualize who the key actors are and the events in Nigerian political space post the 1999 return to democracy. And the idea of this is that it's a youth-led effort to educate people ahead of the election. So these are like different ways that, you know, the youth are using, you know, the internet and social media to help prepare themselves ahead of these upcoming elections.
Aisha, I'm going to come to you on the other side of this little segment. Zimbabweans are also set to go to the polls in 2023 to select their next leader. Now, President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who turns 80 this year, succeeded President Robert Mugabe, who was walked out of office at 93 after nearly 40 years in power. Mnangagwa from the ruling ZANU-PF will face off against Nelson Chamisa from the opposition Movement for a Democratic Change. By the way, Chamisa is nearly half Mnangagwa's age. So we asked people on the streets of the capital, Harare, if they think younger political candidates are in the best position to run a free and democratic society. Here's what they said.
I think we will just say the age does, it's just a number. It's the most qualified. In other words, we want the experience. At the same time, we want current knowledge of systems and applications of all those systems. So we want a technically savvy person. At the same time, we want somebody who understands human nature and who can manage and who can handle human needs with a compassionate heart. So it's both depending on their inclination and their qualification.
That's a difficult one. We just say whoever, the younger one or the older one, whoever has the ability to lead. The older one knows the situation in the country. The younger ones, born free, do not really understand what is wanted in the country.
I don't have a proper answer for young leaders I do not have a proper answer for young leaders, because with young leaders, you see what's happening. They do not know where we came from and where we're going. That's point number one, unlike the old leaders. But there's suppression by both. So I do not believe in young leaders or elders. I don't believe them. That's my answer.
The world is changing, and it needs someone who understands us, the youth, you know, to hear us out and voice our concerns, our worries, our... Yeah, so I believe that definitely it needs a young person to bring democracy to our country.
Zimbabweans, they're telling us if they think younger candidates are best placed to run a free democratic society. Now, Aisha, we just heard that one gentleman there talk about looking for leaders who have compassion and who have an understanding of the human condition. In your experience, how much of a factor is age really, especially when people might want leaders who are new, who are fresh, who are a little younger than, say, 80 years old, and but who also have political, professional, and a bit of life experience at the same time. Do we as the media sometimes conflate enthusiasm with youth? I mean, how big of a difference is there, and how big of a role does age play?
I think age is actually very important. I mean, of course, we're always talking about the fact that Africa is a very young continent with 70% of its population under the age of 30. But when you do a median, an average of the heads of state, you find that the picture is quite different. And we're looking at an average of probably 70, late 70s to 80s. I'm worried. Age is a big factor, I think. One of the reasons is because we're a very patriarchal, traditional society where a lot of respect is given to older people by default. And I can speak for not just Nigeria, but across West Africa and pretty much Africa, where we're very respectful of elders. A lot of our quotes and our what's the word, narratives, childhood stories, all revere old age. That said, I think what's more important, and we are looking forward to the younger people in office, but what's more important, I'm seeing from the conversations that I've been part of on Twitter spaces with the younger generation, that it's not so much the age of a person, but the age of the person's ideas and how well a person has embraced the culture of politics and governance in Africa. What do I mean by that? So you can find young people, and we have had young governors in Nigeria. I mean, the governor of, I think, Cross River State, the governor of Kogi State, they're both fairly young by Nigerian standards. But the way they play politics is exactly the way the old guard would do it, which is why I speak about the age of people's ideas and how well they've embraced the culture of exploitation, which comes with being in government in Nigeria. So, yes, I think the media shouldn't overplay the age of a candidate. It is exciting when you see people who are young, who are fresh, who have ideas. But I think what should be tested is exactly that, their ideas, their message, how well their campaigns deviate from the typical campaign. So if you're a young person, if you're 30 years old and I see you spraying money around, eating corn on the roadside, then I'll know that you're playing politics in the way that the old guard does. But you could be a 50-year-old whose ideas are talking about, you know, the innovation, talking about disruption, talking about the use of technology, saying things that I know tie into someone's understanding of how harmful our political culture is and how important it is to change it. So yes, the media would do well not to be just excited by age, but by the age of the ideas of the candidates.
On behalf of the media, well noted, Aisha. And it is interesting that, you know, often we see in countries, including here in the United States, there's a minimum age to run for office, but no maximum age limit. So a floor, but no ceiling. Temi, you know, in some countries, especially those that have had coups in recent years, we've seen younger leaders emerge in the form of coup leaders. Now, of course, I can understand that sometimes people just want change so badly that they don't mind whatever shape, way, or form it comes in. Do you worry that even just the optics of coup leaders riding in on promises of widespread change, that sends a message that the only way for younger people to come to power is to take it by force?
You know, that's a fair worry, that the only way to come into power would be by force, because those are like the examples that we've seen so far. But I think that this generation knows that, you know, the power of social media and the power of people trying to communicate together, that's also, you know, there are ways to make changes through that. You know, in Nigeria with NSAS, the youth weren't being violent, you know, and we were able to make a really huge difference. So even though, you know, in the grand scheme of things, not much has changed in terms of what the government said they were going to do, and, you know, the answers they were going to give, you know, I think people are, like I said before, are looking towards these elections as a way for, you know, something to actually change this time around. And that was done without any violence from the youth's parts.
Aisha, in many parts of the continent, we've seen young people finding success as entrepreneurs or really, you know, in good jobs in the private sector, both in their home countries and internationally. But how does one then convince more younger people to choose running for political office over success in the private sector? How challenging is that?
Well, I don't think it's becoming too... I think we're bridging the gap. And you're right to identify that there is one between, you know, people sort of going ahead with their lives, achieving things in the way that the FT, I think the Financial Times put it a few days ago in an article that I really liked, where they said Nigeria works when the government is sleeping. So yes, young Nigerians just get on with it. And that's why we're thriving in areas like, you know, tech, our own version of Silicon Valley, fashion, music, Nollywood and all that. Government is largely not there. But I think many young people are also beginning to see that there's a profound link between even their successes and the enjoyment of their successes and government policies. Since NSAS, the government has been quite deliberate about going against tech, trying to find various ways of frustrating, you know, bringing out frustrating regulation policies that are all designed to stifle an area that they don't understand, they can't manipulate, and they're very suspicious about. So since NSAS, I've seen a sense that young people, the entrepreneurs that you just speak about, are understanding that we can do both. We can walk and chew gum. We can try to build vibrant businesses. We can try to have an enjoyable life, but we also have to care about what's going on in our societies, because in one way or the other, it has an impact on us. What sparked NSAS? It was just this whole idea that young people getting on with their lives, trying to go to work, being harassed by the policemen constantly about their hairstyles or their laptops or their phones. So you can try and build a bubble, but the truth is the dysfunction in many African countries, not just Nigeria, will get to you eventually. And I think there's a groundswell built on the back of more connectivity and the internet for young people to compare notes, to see what's happening in Zimbabwe, South Africa, Nigeria, Senegal, and say, we want better as well, and we can come together and make that happen.
Temi, I'm going to ask you to close us briefly here. What is your take on this? And I love that Aisha just mentioned all these examples in other parts of the continent. What makes you hopeful that we can get young people in larger numbers even interested in political parties, no matter success, the success they find elsewhere?
Yeah, like I was saying before, you know, in terms of the government answering to the demands of protesters doing NSAS, not much changed in that regard. But in terms of the youth seeing what they're capable of, the whole world was watching NSAS. Like, everyone stopped to see what young Nigerians were doing on the streets. And the amount of money that Feminist Coalition and all these other organizations were able to raise as well truly showed the power of social media, of connectivity, of young people communicating and sharing notes and also looking to other countries that was like was mentioned before. You know, Nigeria is a deeply divided democracy. We have, you know, it's a multi-religious society. So I think we're definitely going to need somebody who can kind of connect and, you know, different people from these different groups can, you know, really understand them. But I think the frustration and the sense of hopelessness that, you know, a lot of Nigerians are facing, that's really what's going to be the catalyst for change. 100% harassment, threats, gaslighting, these are things that, you know, the older generation are going to try to use to stop young people. So it's not going to be an easy road, but, you know, it's what's necessary if we want to end strongmen politics in Africa.
Ladies, we're going to have to leave it there. What a fantastic conversation. I regret that we've run out of time. I thank the both of you for your insights, your perspectives, and, of course, for your time.
Thank you.
It's time for a short break here. When Straight Talk Africa returns, we'll turn our focus to the 2022 U.S. midterm elections.
We're going to really address the issue of having women, particularly Black women, in positions of power at the national level. We have to start at the local level.
We'll show you the candidates looking to make history in Washington and states across America. My guests, Maria Bird and Calvin Dark, will be here to help break it all down for us. So stay with Straight Talk Africa. We're back in a moment.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Linoch Mudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
This is Straight Talk Africa on VOA. Welcome back. March is Women's History Month here in the United States, so it's probably a good time to talk about the women looking to make history in the U.S. midterm elections, which are set for later this year in November, of course. Now, this is the midpoint of the U.S. president's term of office. Joe Biden won't be on the ballot, but every seat in the House of Representatives will be up for election, and about one-third of the country's 100 Senate seats. That's not all. Many states are holding elections at the same time. So we'll see a slew of state legislature and gubernatorial elections. Black women candidates believe this is their chance to make historic gains in Washington and in battleground states. Women like Democrat Congresswoman Val Demings challenging Republican Senator Marco Rubio in Florida and Cherie Beasley running for U.S. Senate in North Carolina. Things are looking a bit lonelier for Black women on the Republican Senate side. Army veteran Kathy Barnett is running for the U.S. Senate in Pennsylvania. If elected, she will make history as the first Black female Republican elected to the U.S. Senate. And one of the big gubernatorial candidacies to look out for is that of Stacey Abrams. The Democrat is running for governor of the state of Georgia in what looks set to be a rematch against the current Republican governor, Brian Kemp, who narrowly beat Abrams in the 2018 midterms. You may remember that. Now, joining me to discuss this is Calvin Dark from RC Communications. He's a U.S. and international affairs commentator, and he joins us here in Washington, D.C. via Skype. And journalist Maria Bird also joins us here in Washington. She's based here and covers politics for Nigeria's Channels Television. Welcome to both of you. Calvin, I'd like you to start us off here. Now, we see Black women aiming to really correct the disparities that have been around for a long time, but they seem to face myths about their electability. I want you to explain this to our audience and to me, someone who didn't grow up in this country and still finds it hard that we're having these kinds of conversations in 2022. Black women, there is this myth that they can't win at the ballot box, and that in general, they can't really transcend race, gender, age, and of course the political divide. Are those perceptions changing, and who are the women proving these ideas wrong?
Well, you know, the word electability, in my conversations with friends and colleagues who also didn't grow up in the United States, they always wonder, what exactly does this mean in this context? And the way that I like to explain it is this. Every candidate individually has electability, whether we think they can win. But the difference is, if we take a white male candidate, for example, a specific one, we can say what their strengths and weaknesses are based on who they are, what they've done, what their experiences are. But when it comes to Black women, we don't even have to know that. We immediately have a conversation that starts off with, can a Black woman be president, governor, senator, whatever the race? So I think that that is why electability is key for many minority candidates, but especially Black women, because we have a huge racial problem in this country and a huge misogyny problem in this country. And so Black women are facing both of those challenges. However, I am encouraged by examples like Stacey Abrams, who proved to us that anything is possible, and the way that she came back and, you know, got her ground game for the state of Georgia and had two Democratic Senate seats, one in a runoff election in January during a pandemic. But also people from my home state, for example, Cheri Beasley, who was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, lost her re-election. People talk about, well, can she win statewide? Can she be senator? She lost by 400 votes out of about 5 million casts. So I don't know what says more clearly that she could definitely win than that. So we have to fight those challenges of electability, but we also have to make sure that they don't become a self-proclaiming prophecy, that we are told they can't be elected and then we don't vote for them and the cycle continues and continues.
Speaking of women, Black women running for governor, Maria, I found it surprising that the United States has never had a Black woman governor. Why is this the case?
You know, that's a very interesting question, and I think it's one that we have to really look at the power of a governor. The governor has tremendous power in the state. When we really look at the racial undertones that exist in our country, we know that Black women have said the problem. And so when you look at why would a Black woman be a governor at this time in our country, knowing the role that unfortunately women, and especially Black women, have been disproportionately adversely brought against for many years in our country. And so this is, I think, a coming of the times. I think that it's very surprising as we think about we have our first African-American, Asian, Pacific Islander American woman as vice president, but still, we are still seeking that governorship role from someone of an African-American and a woman. And so we know there's very few women that have served in those roles as well. So this is, I think, something that we're going to see, hopefully, in the coming years that we will begin to see the first African-American governor. We know that Senate didn't even get its first African-American senator until the mid-90s. So.
Kelvin, we spoke earlier, or I spoke earlier, about how lonely it is for Black women in Senate races on the Republican side and, of course, in terms of running for governor. But you sent me a quick email last night and reminded me about the number of Black women lieutenant governors on the Republican side. And, of course, a lieutenant governor is like the deputy of a state governor, correct?
Yes. And I think that what that shows us is, one, I think that if we're going to really address the issue of having women, particularly Black women, in positions of power at the national level, we have to start at the local level. That's why I'm a big proponent of encouraging a pipeline. You know, a lot of these key decisions are not just made in the Senate and the White House, but they're made in city councils, on school boards, you know, state level offices. And the bigger the pipeline is, the more candidates we'll have who are diverse, who are Black women that can go for those national races. But I did find it interesting, which is why I sent you the email, is that I was thinking about lieutenant governors and that how they are, I think, best poised to become governors in a lot of states. As I was looking through the list, several, if not the majority of the Black female lieutenant governors we've had have been Republicans. And if we think about the most prominent, most recent in Virginia, we're talking about conservative Black women. And I think that's a really interesting perspective and something really interesting to think about, that why for that state level race, Black Republican women seem to have a slightly better foothold than Black Democratic women.
That is fascinating. Maria, how do Democrats and Republicans see the representation of black women and women of color in general in this country in their party, and what are they doing or not doing to ensure there is more gender and racial diversity in their ranks and among their candidates vying for elected office?
We must remember the history of our politics, especially within the African-American community. Many African-Americans post-Abraham Lincoln were Republicans. African-Americans becoming Democrats is a new phenomenon. That's really after the FDR era. And so we know that for many African-Americans, especially those who've seen the Republican Party, they have a long family history of being Republicans. And so that's oftentimes what you'll see. You think about Condoleezza Rice serving under George Bush and kind of her role what she played. And so, and as you all just mentioned, the Virginia Lieutenant Governor, we know that, that she has a long history within the Republican Party. So you'll see some of those long history ties. In the Democratic Party, you'll see many African-Americans are those who are advocates, who are those who have been fighting for civil rights for many years. And so that's kind of where we've seen the turn with many African-Americans getting to the Democratic Party. But we also know that as we've seen over the past year, you know, African-Americans are still not happy with either party. So I think African-American women who have really become the heartbeat in so many ways of our American political electorate and really looking at those who are going out to vote and having a major impact on voters, they are too now saying that their voice is going to be heard. And I think that Americans are beginning to listen. And so as we think through what this midterm election is going to look like, and we know we just had an election where we saw a couple of African-American women win congressional seats. We know that this is definitely going to be a turning point, and it will really dictate and really give insight into where the role of African-American women will be in the future of our election.
Well, speaking of turning points here, Calvin, earlier, of course, in my introduction, I mentioned several black women candidacies to watch closely in the midterms, and you pointed out Stacey Abrams. Who else should we watch closely, and what should we watch closely in the U.S. midterms?
Well, I think that Stacey Abrams, definitely, Cherry Beasley, I think Val Demings in Florida, that'll be an interesting race because I think she has an uphill battle because Florida not only is a very challenging state politically, especially for Democrats, but the former president, Donald Trump, has kind of camped down there. And well, with the governor, the Republican governor, that's going to be hard. But I think that if you look at the polling now, she's doing really well against Marco Rubio, the incumbent. So I think it's possible we're going to see a tough fight there. But just stepping back a little bit, one of the things that I'm going to be watching and hopefully not cringing as much as I'm fearing is between the races for the midterms that involve black women and the Supreme Court pick from Biden of a black woman, we're really going to see how awkward and clumsy a lot of lawmakers, particularly on the Republican side, how they're going to be when they talk about black women, the importance of black women, the role of black women in politics at all level. It's going to be cringeworthy, but I think it's going to be necessary because we need to get past this, have these conversations so that black women can be in the forefront. They've been in the background. They've been voting. They've been running elections. They've been managing things. Let's put them in the positions of power where they deserve to be, and let's get through this hurdle.
And it's my honor to introduce to the country a daughter of former public school teachers, a proven consensus builder, an accomplished lawyer, a distinguished jurist, one of the nation's most prestigious courts. My nominee for the United States Supreme Court is Judge Ketanji Jackson.
If I am fortunate enough to be confirmed as the next Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, I can only hope that my life and career, my love of this country and the Constitution, and my commitment to upholding the rule of law and the sacred principles upon which this great nation was founded will inspire future generations of Americans.
I want to continue along that thread. You know, Joe Biden's promise, of course, that he will nominate a black woman to the U.S. Supreme Court. Why has this become such a controversy when it is very clear, just looking at the makeup of the Supreme Court, that there are no black women represented on the highest court in the land? Why has this become such a controversy?
Well, I laugh every time I see people talking about it being controversy, because there wasn't a controversy when only white men were eligible to be in these positions. So I think that I think that it's a controversy because we're uncomfortable in this country speaking about race in this way. But I think facing it and talking about it will help people to see that, as you said, we're righting a wrong. We're adding diversity to the positions of power to reflect the people in this country, not just those who've traditionally held on to power and kept it from other people.
Kelvin Dark from RC Communications and Maria Bird, who is the Washington-based correspondent for Nigeria's Channels TV. Thank you, both of you, for your time. This was a great conversation. Great to have you on the show, and I'm going to call you, both of you, back on the show sometime soon again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we've got a great story for you after the break.
This is Dr. Oye Owolewa. I live in Washington, D.C. I'm the first Nigerian-American elected as U.S. representative.
A Nigerian-American who made history in Washington politics, and why he's pushing for the nation's capital to come out of the shadows towards statehood. You do not want to miss his story. Straight Talk Africa is back in a moment. You're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. He's a pharmacist and a history-making politician born to Nigerian parents, and he's determined to change the fate of 700,000 Americans who lack voting representation in the U.S. Congress. In November 2000, Oye Owolewa was elected to a two-year term as Washington, D.C.'s so-called shadow U.S. representative. Now, the U.S. Capitol is not part of a state, so representatives like Owolewa are not officially acknowledged in Congress. So Owolewa says he's determined to change that and help lead the push to make Washington, D.C. America's 51st state. Here is his story, produced by VOA's Betty Ayoub.
This is Dr. Oye Owolewa. I live in Washington, D.C. I'm the first Nigerian-American elected as U.S. representative. I took my oath of office on January 2nd in front of the Martin Luther King Memorial in D.C.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States and the District of Columbia Home Rule Act.
Everybody who was with me from day one was there. My younger brother, who's my best friend, who also served as my treasurer, my right-hand man. They were able to witness me give my commencement speech to becoming D.C.'s first Nigerian-American federal official. I just thought about everybody that got me to this point. My parents, who were born and raised in Nigeria, who taught me about community, about selflessness, giving back to others. Also, all the people who have invested in me, whether it's teachers, whether it's my current neighbors, just everything that brought me to that point. It was a very overwhelming experience.
Together, we will fight for change and finally achieve D.C. statehood.
When I first ran for U.S. representative, it was all about bringing equality for D.C. residents.
Right now, we pay taxes. We pay our fair share as American citizens, but we don't get back what everybody else is. So I was born and raised in Massachusetts. I didn't realize coming into D.C. I'd be forfeiting my rights. And there are people who were born and raised in D.C. who never had the rights that our neighbors in Maryland and Virginia have. My other message was being a representative to people who share my perspective, the Nigerian Americans, the millennials, black people, Muslim Americans, anybody who sees themselves fighting to see themselves represented. I have shared that voice, and that's what I bring to the lawmaking process. USA! 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 The Capitol siege had a huge consequence, not only physically for D.C., but our spirit as well. It also highlighted the importance of D.C. statehood, the ability to defend ourselves, create our own laws, create a budget to prevent this from happening again. Unlike other representatives of other states, this seat is a non-voting, non-seated U.S. representative. So I don't get any federal funding or budget for my office. So because of that, I still continue my day practice as a healthcare professional. And what that has done is inspired me to also focus on healthcare just as much as D.C. statehood.
So this is the first shot of two?
So once I'm able to become a seated voting member of Congress, I'm going to work on changing our healthcare system, make sure it's fair and affordable for every American. Being a healthcare worker, I really, really believe that there's an opportunity for me to educate the community about vaccines, especially the COVID vaccine.
My name is Dr. Oye Oluwa, U.S. representative. I'm working with the mayor's office to make sure people are vaccinated. Have you gotten vaccinated already?
I hear a lot of lawmakers saying trust the science. But being a healthcare provider and elected official, I feel like I have the perspective and the opportunity to really educate the community on a mass level. And it's really good to do your part and make sure that the country is safer. And I believe getting vaccinated is a step to making our country safer and ready to open again.
All right, guys. And like I said, thanks for doing your part to get us past the pandemic.
Thank you.
And if you know anybody else who needs to get one, they can do the same thing.
All right.
Awesome.
Thank you.
All right, guys.
My family back in Nigeria and extended friends, they are extremely proud of this accomplishment. This is the first time a Nigerian American has been elected to such a position. And they see this not only as a win for me, but also an opportunity for the younger generation to get more inspired in the political process. And not even just Nigerian Americans, but just people from all the diaspora. Because we come here, we excel academically, we achieve a lot, but right now there's not a lot of political capital in our communities. So this is an opportunity for us to really get involved in a lawmaking process. But as a black man as well, I feel like this is also an opportunity for young black people to understand that this is our opportunity to take our energy in the streets and bring it to a lawmaking table. This is an opportunity to really be involved in the solutions of what's going on in our community and just make life just a little bit more comfortable, a little bit easier for the next person. And that's an opportunity that I take very, very seriously.
Okay, now how amazing is that? And that is our show this week. Thank you to all my guests for joining me. Thanks to our affiliates who are airing Straight Talk Africa across the African continent. And thanks to you for your company on television, radio, and online. I will see you next time. Until then, it's goodbye.